You know, there's a reason for cautionary tales.
Then why don't more people heed their warnings?
I don't know. But after they hear my new show, they will think twice.
Oh yeah? About what?
Eating Tide Pods, playing with Ouija boards, talking to Karens, you name it. If you should heed caution, we're talking about it.
Check out Harper's brand new podcast, Cautionary Tales with Harper. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you download podcasts.
And be sure to press subscribe and give us a review.
Cautionary Tales with Harper.
Subscribe wherever you download podcasts today.
A man who confessed to 27 murders, of which only 9 could be confirmed. Rumors of his rampage possibly including up to 300. Just who was H.H. Holmes, and why did he have such a dark and lurid taste for death? That's the story we learn about today on The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Herman Webster Mudgett, better known as Dr. Henry Howard Holmes, or H.H. Holmes, was an American serial killer. While he confessed to 27 murders, only 9 could be plausibly confirmed, and several of the people he claimed to have murdered were still alive at the time of his confession. Despite the confession of the 27 murders, it is speculated that Holmes may have killed as many as 200 people. Many victims were killed in a mixed-use building, which he owned, located about 3 miles west of the 1893 World's Fair Columbian Exposition, supposedly called the World's Fair Hotel, informally called the Murder Castle, though evidence suggests the hotel portion was never truly open for business. Besides being a serial killer, Holmes was also a con artist and a bigamist, the subject of more than 50 lawsuits in the Chicago area alone. Holmes was executed on May 7th, 1896, 9 days before his 35th birthday, for the murder of his friend and accomplice Benjamin Pitzel. During his trial for the murder of Pitzel, Holmes confessed to many other killings. So you think the world is crazy right now? Well, you're right, it is. But also, it's been crazy for a long time, in many ways, shapes, and forms. And H.H. Holmes is one of those stories where if it were going on today, probably still wouldn't make front page news in the current climate. But a year ago would have certainly been, you know, the Dateline topic of the year. But quite a dark story that dates back to the 1800s. And I would actually say he got quite a lot done in his 35 years on this earth. Not in a good way, but still accomplished quite a bit. If the allegations are true of over 200 people murdered by a single human being and you're 35 at death, wow, that's is there a record for that? Does Guinness do that? I'm not sure. It's The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Tony Bruschi, that's me, and Sean Reed joining us on today's episode. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you listen to the podcast. Have you heard of H.H. Before?
No, but a few things come to mind, Tony. Good to talk to you. If he is, I'm a sports guy. If he is looking to get drafted, say the NFL draft, with his productivity, they would say he has a high motor, strong work ethic, motivated, gets the job done. And furthermore, I think if he had any success in professional sports, H.H. Holmes, I think they'd call him Triple H.
Yeah.
Thirdly, I can see why he went with Holmes. Mudgett, not a good look. And yeah. Finally, any relation to Sherlock?
Not that I'm aware of.
When it comes to find out that he killed hundreds, but then they only knew of 27 and only 9 can be confirmed. Mm-hmm. What did he do as much as we think he did? were there hundreds? Maybe he just killed just nine.
Or
which, yeah, it's just nine. Would we even be talking about him right now?
Did he inflate his numbers to make him sound more impressive historically, knowing that years from now, a podcast would be talking about his story, and he wanted to make sure he looked good 120 some years after his death?
As sarcastic as we're being, similarly, if you're a professional athlete, or even back in, you know, you're a current day insurance salesman, but you were the star quarterback back in high school, the pinnacle of your life. Oh yeah, I threw for 7,000 yards and 49 touchdowns. If you are a murderer, okay, if you have taken a life,
that's your thing.
Oh, fuck, yeah, I took 42 lives. Hell, back in 1864, I took 142 in 1 month. You know, you want to inflate yourself, and I don't know, man, but taking a look at a picture of this fella, that is, he's got a really good stash. That is a full mustache, a nice top hat, and that, is that a Windsor tie?
I believe so. He doesn't look like your typical murderer or serial killer. Doesn't. Although
he saved me 15% on my insurance back in, you know, the 1850s, not take my life.
I would expect the same. Unfortunately, it seems to go the other way. Let's dig more into the story of H.H. Holmes and see just how legitimate the claims of that many dead actually are. Holmes was born as Herman Webster Mudgett in Gilmatron, New Hampshire, in the U.S., May 16th, 1861, to Levi Horton Mudgett and Theodrate Page Price, both of whom were described from the first English immigrants in the area. Mudgett was his parents' third-born child. He had an older sister, Ellen, and a older brother, Arthur, a younger brother, Henry, and a younger sister, Mary. Holmes' father was from a farming family, and at times he worked as a farmer, trader, and house painter. His parents were devout Methodists. Later attempts to fit Holmes into his patterns seen in the modern serial killers had described him as torturing animals and suffering from abuse at the hands of a violent father, but contemporary and eyewitness accounts of his childhood did not provide proof of either. At the age of 16, Holmes graduated from Phillips Exeter Academy and took teaching jobs in Gilmanton and later in nearby Alton. On January 4th, 1878, he married Clara Lovering in Alton. Their son, Robert Lovering Mudgett, was born on February 3rd, 1880, in London, New Hampshire. As an adult, Robert became a certified public accountant and served as city manager of Orlando, Florida. Holmes enrolled in the University of Vermont in Burlington, Vermont, at age 18, but was dissatisfied with the school and left after 1 year. In 1882, he entered the University of Michigan's Department of Medicine and Surgery and graduated in June 1884 after passing his exams. While enrolled, he worked in the anatomy lab under Professor Herdman, the chief of anatomy instructor. Holmes had apprenticed in New Hampshire under Dr. Noam Witz, a noted advocate of human dissection. Years later, when Holmes was suspected of murder and claimed to be nothing but an insurance fraudster, he admitted to using cadavers to defraud life insurance companies several times in college. Housemates described Holmes as treating Clara violently, and in 1884, before his graduation, she moved back to New Hampshire and later wrote she knew little of him afterwards. After he moved to Moore's Forks, New York, a rumor spread that Holmes had been seen with a little boy who later disappeared. Holmes claimed the boy went back to his home in Massachusetts. No investigation took place, and Holmes quickly left town. He later traveled to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and got a job as a keeper at the Norristown State Hospital, but quit after a few days. He later took a position at a drugstore in Philadelphia, but while he was working there, a boy died after taking medicine that was purchased at the store. Holmes denied any involvement in the child's death and immediately left the city. Right before moving to Chicago, he changed his name to Henry Howard Holmes to avoid the possibility of being exposed by victims of his previous scams. In his confession after his arrest, Holmes claims he had killed his former medical school classmate, Dr. Robert Leacock, in 1886 for insurance money. Dr. Leacock, however, died in Watford, Ontario, in Canada on October 5th, 1889. In late 1886, while still married to Clara Holmes, married Marta Belknap in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He filed for divorce from Clara a few weeks after marrying Marta, alleging infidelity on her part. The claims cannot be proven and the suit went nowhere. Surviving paperwork indicated she probably was never even informed of the suit. In any case, the divorce was never finalized. It was dismissed on June 4, 1891 on the grounds of want of prosecution. Holmes had a daughter with Marta, Lucy Theodate Holmes, who was born on July 4, 1889 in Englewood, Chicago, Illinois. As an adult, Lucy became a public school teacher. Holmes lived with Marta and Lucy in Wilmette, Illinois, and spent most of his time in Chicago tending to business. Holmes married Georgina Yoke on January 17, 1894 in Denver, Colorado, while still married to both Clara and Marta. Holmes arrived in Chicago in August 1886, which is when he began using the name H.H. Holmes. He came across Elizabeth S. Holton's drugstore at the southwest corner of South Wallace Avenue and West 63rd Street in Englewood. Holton gave Holmes a job, and he proved to be a hardworking employee, eventually buying the store. Although several books portray Holton's husband as an old man who quickly vanished along with his wife, Dr. Holton was a fellow Michigan alums, only a few years older than Holmes, and both Holtons remained in Englewood throughout Holmes' life and survived well into the 20th century. It's a myth that they were killed by Holmes. Holmes purchased an empty lot across from the drugstore where construction began in 1887 for a two-story mixed-use building with apartments on the second floor and retail spaces, including a new drugstore on the first. When Holmes declined to pay the architects or the steel company, Aetna Iron and Steel sued in 1888, and in 1892 he added a third floor, telling investors and suppliers he intended to use it as a hotel during the upcoming World's Columbian Exposition, though the hotel portion was never completed. Furniture suppliers found Holmes was hiding their materials, for which he had never paid, in hidden rooms and passages throughout the buildings. There were soundproofed rooms and mazes of hallways, some of which seemed to go nowhere. Many of the rooms were outfitted with chutes that would drop straight down to the basement, where Holmes had acid vats, quicklime, and a crematorium to dispose of his victims' bodies. Their search made the news, and investors for the planned hotel pulled out of the deal when a jeweler in the building showed them the articles. The hotel was gutted by a fire started by an unknown arsonist shortly after Holmes was arrested, but largely rebuilt and used as a post office until 1938. In 1892, the hotel was somewhat completed with three stories and a basement. The first floor was a storefront. The second story consisted of his elaborate torture rooms, which contained a chute that led to the basement. The third floor held more apartment rooms. In 1894, some police officers inspected the hotel while Holmes was out. During the inspection, they found rooms with hinged walls, false partitions, rooms linked with secret passageways, and even airtight rooms that were connected to pipelines filled with gas, which Holmes used as gas chambers. Holmes would use chutes to deliver the bodies to the basement, and once there, he made use of surgical tables and an array of medical tools to dissect them before selling their organs and bones on the black market to medical institutions. One of Holmes' early murder victims was his mistress, Julia Smythe. She was the wife of Ned Connor, who had moved into Holmes' building and began working at his pharmacy's jewelry counter. After Connor found out about Smith's affair with Holmes, he quit his job and moved away, leaving Smith and her daughter Pearl behind. Smith gained custody of Pearl and remained at the hotel, continuing her relationship with Holmes. Julia and Pearl disappeared on Christmas Eve of 1891, and Holmes later claimed she had died during an abortion, though what truly thought to have happened to the two was never confirmed. Another likely Holmes Parmore, Elmore Surrogained, began working in the building in May of 1892 and disappeared that December. Another woman who vanished, Edna Van Tassel, is also believed to have been among Holmes' victims. While working in the Chemical Bank building on Dearborn Street, Holmes met and became close friends with Benjamin Pitzel, a carpenter with a criminal past who was exhibiting in the same building a coal bin he had invented. Holmes used Pitzel as his right-hand man for several criminal schemes. A district attorney later described Pitzel as Holmes' tool, his creature. In early 1893, a one-time actress named Minnie Williams moved to Chicago. Holmes claimed to have met her in an employment office, though there were rumors he had met her in Boston years earlier. He offered her a job at the hotel and his personal stenographer, and she accepted. Holmes persuaded Williams to transfer the deed to her property in Fort Worth, Texas, to a man named Alexander Bond, an alias of Holmes. In April of 1893, Williams transferred the deed with Holmes serving as the notary. Holmes later signed the deed over to Pitzel, giving him the alias Benton T. Lyman. The next month, Holmes and Williams, presenting themselves as man and wife, rented an apartment in Chicago's Lincoln Park. Minnie's sister Annie came to visit, and in July, she wrote to her aunt that she planned to accompany brother Harry to Europe. Neither Minnie nor Annie were seen alive after July 5th, 1893. So, thus far, seems like a very creative individual. One who you'd say thinks out of the box a little bit. Thoughts thus far?
He had a, what vat? Vat did he have in his basement? A crematorium?
Crematorium. He had lime and some other chemicals, whatever you use to dissolve bodies. Kind of like Breaking Bad, kind of Walter White-ish. He had a gas chamber, rooms that led to nowhere. He had chutes from the upper floor so he could just throw the bodies into the basement to be disposed of. My God. And at the same time, trying to create a little Airbnb in the top floor with all this going on for the World's Fair.
You can hang out in the bedroom upstairs. Don't you worry about the noises you hear downstairs. Now, the place that he had, it was a post office, and then he lived there, and then it became a post office.
It turned into a post office after his death, I believe. The building, there was an arson, and then someone bought the property and then kind of tried to do a little murder rehab on it.
Got it. So the chutes that had bodies go down them then also had your electric bill go down them.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how that all worked. I wonder if they turned them into like dumbwaiters or something. It's like, what's the chute for? Bodies? Well, let's use it for a dumbwaiter. We can bring food to the third floor that way. Great idea. Let's do it. I don't know. It just the ingenuity of serial killers back in that time, quite impressive. I'd say they really kind of blew away most of the modern day serial killers in terms of the infrastructure which they set up. You know, serial killers these days, you know, they have to be more secretive. They go around and do their thing and have to kind of hide in the shadows. This guy had a full fucking funhouse complex set up and kind of a factory setting, which I don't think we've seen quite like this. I mean, even Dahmer's apartment was nowhere near the level of complexity that Holmes had going on there in Chicago.
Well, what we're learning is we now find out how he could be so efficient in killing so many in such little time. He had a plan of attack, and he was all about effective and efficiency. You don't want to carry your bodies down flights of stairs. You just have a chute, similar to living in an apartment complex, a garbage chute on the 13th floor. Rather than walking a dozen flights of stairs, you just pop it in and poof, it's gone.
Yeah. It's quite amazing. I've said this before, but I wonder how common it was for people just to disappear back then and nothing is said or happened about it, because there's only so much evidence you could go on. There wasn't really, you know, detailed forensic evidence or DNA evidence or anything like that. It was just like, people talk about the wild, wild west, but you know, in a way the whole country had a vibe to that where, you know, if you're a real deviant psychopath like Holmes, you could get away with your shit for a long time if you were calculated about it. It makes me wonder how many characters like this, you know, we only know about the ones that were caught. How many of these characters like this existed that were out there that just never got caught, ended up dying, and, you know, that was the end of the story? And we'll never know the story because there was no way to know the answer unless you were caught in it.
I think not only the late 1800s, but I mean the 1970s, the 1980s, current day. If we tried to, and I'm not insinuating, if you want to fall off the face of the earth, you can't, because you very much can. But we have a GPS system essentially attached to our hip in our phone.
Yeah.
Or our car, or our laptop. So I think it would be a little bit more difficult should we be fortunate enough to have people in our lives that care for us, that when we get lost, they would do everything they can to find us. But back in the day, prior to technology, I think it would be a little bit easier. And I think people would not be trained in their brain so much to have such easy ways or top of mind ways to search for you.
Yeah.
30 years ago, 40 years ago. I mean, when you're going to a gas station to use a phone, or you're looking in a physical hard copy book for a phone number, by the way, it's called a phone book. Mm-hmm. There was a Yellow Pages and a White Pages. White Pages residential, Yellow Pages professional. But your brain only in the last, 5, 10 years has had so much, well, just Google it, mm-hmm. or just find my iPhone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot easier to follow the face of the earth before we just had so many ways to find someone.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. It's very interesting just how much can be done, using technology to figure out how did these things happen? You have security cameras everywhere. Someone went missing. They can track, well, the Pomida down there has a security camera. The Citco has one. Everything, all these things you can look at now that didn't even exist 20 years ago. So there's a lot of ways of tracking these things down.
An average week, the average human is on video 20,000 times.
And we have no idea because we don't realize where all those cameras are. And that's, I have no issue with it. I'm like, okay, whatever. I have nothing to hide. I'm all about having personal privacy, but when you're out in public and stuff, why, I don't feel the pressure there of like why this is a bad thing. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm missing something, but I personally, same with like the Alexas and stuff, people are like, oh, it's listening in on you. Okay. What's the worst it's going to do? It's going to start suggesting that I should buy, an Xbox or something because it heard me talking about it, or, I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying anything in my house that I really wouldn't want other people to hear. And if it's of a personal nature, it's not threatening to anyone. So I don't care all that much. I enjoy the conveniences that it offers far more than I think the negatives of there's something listening to you. And I know that can be used, 50 different ways, and there are valid arguments against it, but I kind of run on the assumption of if I really have nothing to hide, why would I really care? I don't know. Maybe I'm missing something, but that's just kind of how I operate. And there's probably somebody screaming at me going, no, it's wrong. Okay. You're entitled to your opinion too. But for me, it doesn't bother me. So
I think if your identity was stolen or you had to go through the absolute insanity of trying to take care of something like that and to each their own, I understand people's points of privacy, et cetera. To just put to end point on that 20,000, primarily traffic cameras, interstate system, dealing with Department of Transportation's, that's the primary cameras. But as far as information, and sadly, you can never be too protective of your private information.
No.
Not necessarily what it is, whether you want a new pair of shoes or a new car, or you're talking about your social security number. It is a game that people are getting better and better at of taking that information. So I get where people are in that situation. I personally don't have the Alexa because, quite honestly, I'm a little bit more old school where you have to physically type in or physically search, not insinuating somebody's going to steal my information. But I do understand and respect where other people are hey, stop looking at my information or stealing it or trying to. And again, it all comes down to a very boring thing. Hey, respect others' opinions, whether you agree with it or not, unless it directly involves your health, physical or mental. Who the fuck cares? I don't care if you are voting for that person and I'm voting for this person. I don't give a fuck as long as it's not going to directly affect me.
Let's continue on with the story of HH and just see how dark things get. Holmes had an entrepreneurial spirit. Based on his former medical education and his connections, he was able to sell skeletons to medical labs and schools. He and sometimes a hired assistant were accused of stripping the flesh off of bodies, dissecting them, and preparing the viable skeletons. The rest of the remains should be tossed in pits of lime or acid, effectively breaking down the remaining evidence. With insurance companies pressing to prosecute Holmes for arson, Holmes left Chicago in July of 1894. He reappeared in Fort Worth, where he had inherited property from the Williams sisters, located at the intersection of modern-day Commerce Street and 2nd Street. There, he sought to construct another castle along the lines of his Chicago operation, once again swindling a number of suppliers. In July of 1894, Holmes was arrested and briefly incarcerated for the first time on the charge of selling mortgaged goods in St. Louis, Missouri. He was promptly bailed out, but while in jail, he struck up a conversation with a convicted outlaw named Marion Hedgepath, who was serving a 25-year sentence. Holmes had concocted a plan to swindle an insurance company out of $10,000, equivalent to $296,000 in 2020, by taking out a policy on himself and then faking his death. Holmes promised Hedgepath a $500 commission in exchange for the name of a lawyer who could be trusted. Holmes was directed to a young St. Louis attorney named Jephthah Howe. Howe was in practice with his older brother, Alfonso Howe, who had no involvement with Holmes or Pitzel or their fraudulent activities. Jephthah Howe, however, found Holmes' scheme brilliant. Nevertheless, Holmes' plan to fake his own death failed when the insurance company became suspicious and refused to pay. Holmes did not press the claim. Instead, he contacted a similar plan with Pitzel. Pitzel agreed to fake his own death so that his wife could collect on the $10,000 life insurance policy, which she was to split with Holmes and Jephthah Howe. The scheme, which was to take place in Philadelphia, called for Pitzel to set himself up as an inventor under the name B.F. Perry and then be killed and disfigured in a lab explosion. Holmes was to find an appropriate cadaver to play the role of Pitzel. Instead, Holmes killed Pitzel by knocking him unconscious with chloroform and setting his body on fire with the use of benzene. In his confession, Holmes implied Pitzel was still alive after he used the chloroform on him prior to being set on fire. However, forensic evidence presented at Holmes' later trial showed chloroform had been administered after Pitzel's death, a fact which the insurance company was unaware of, presumably to fake suicide to exonerate Holmes should he be charged with murder. Holmes collected the insurance payout on the basis of the genuine Pitzel corpse. Holmes then went on to manipulate Pitzel's unsuspecting wife into allowing three of her five children, Alice, Nellie, and Howard, to be in his custody. The eldest daughter and the baby remained with Mrs. Pitzel. Holmes and the three Pitzel children traveled throughout the northern United States and into Canada. Simultaneously, he escorted Mrs. Pitzel along a parallel route, all while using various aliases and lying to Miss Pitzel concerning her husband's death, claiming Pitzel was hiding in London, as well as lying to her about the true whereabouts of her three missing children. In Detroit, just prior to entering Canada, they were only separated by a few blocks. An even more audacious move, Holmes was staying in another location with his wife, who was unaware of the whole affair. Holmes, who would later confess to murdering Alice and Nellie by forcing them into a large trunk and locking them inside, he drilled a hole in the lid of the trunk and put one end of a hose through the hole, attaching the other end to a gas line to asphyxiate the girls. Holmes buried their nude bodies in the cellar of his rental house at 16th Vincent Street in Toronto. This home and address no longer exist, St. Vincent Street having long since been realigned into a part of Bay Street. Frank Geyer, a Philadelphia police detective assigned to investigate Holmes and find the three missing children, found the decomposing bodies of the two Pitzel girls in the cellar of the Toronto home. Detective Greer wrote, "The deeper we dug, the more horrible the odor became, and when we reached the depth of 3 feet, we discovered what appeared to be the bone of the forearm of a human being." Greer then went to Indianapolis, where Holmes had rented a cottage. Holmes was reported to have visited a local pharmacy to purchase the drugs which he used to kill Howard Pitzel, and a repair shop to sharpen the knives he used to chop up the body before he burned it. The boy's teeth and bits of bone were discovered in Holmes' chimney. Holmes' murder spree finally ended when he was arrested in Boston on November 17, 1894, after being tracked there from Philadelphia by the Pinkertons. He was held on an outstanding warrant for horse theft in Texas, as the authorities had become more suspicious at this point, and Holmes appeared poised to flee the country in the company of his unsuspecting third wife. Following the discovery of Alice and Nellie's bodies in July 1895, Chicago police and reporters began investigating Holmes' building in Englewood, now locally referred to as the Castle. Though many sensational claims were made, no evidence was found which could have convicted Holmes in Chicago. According to Seltzer, stories of torture equipment found in the building are 20th century fiction. In October 1895, Holmes was put on trial for the murder of Benjamin Pitchell and was found guilty and sentenced to death. By then, it was evident Holmes had also murdered the Pitchell children. Following his conviction, Holmes confessed to 27 murders in Chicago, Indianapolis, and Toronto. Though some persons he confessed to murdering were still alive. And six attempted murders, Holmes was paid $7,500 by the Hearst newspapers in exchange for his confession, which was quickly found to be mostly nonsense. Holmes gave various contradictory accounts of his life, initially claiming innocence and later that he was possessed by Satan. His propensity for lying made it difficult for researchers to discern the truth on the basis of his statements. While writing his confession in prison, Holmes mentioned how drastically his facial appearance had changed since his imprisonment. He described his new grim appearance as gruesome and taking a satanical cast, and wrote he was now convinced that after everything that he had done, he was beginning to resemble the devil. On May 7th, 1896, Holmes was hanged at Moisimang Prison, also known as the Philadelphia County Prison, for the murder of Pitzel. Until the moment of his death, Holmes remained calm and amiable, showing very few signs of fear, anxiety, or depression. Despite this, he asked for his coffin to be contained in cement and buried 10 feet deep because he was concerned grave robbers would steal his body and use it for dissection. Holmes' neck did not snap. He instead strangled to death, slowly twitching for over 15 minutes before being pronounced dead 20 minutes after the trap had been sprung. On New Year's Eve 1909, Hedgepath, who had been pardoned for informing on Holmes, was shot and killed by police officer Edward Jaberick during a holdup at a Chicago saloon. On March 7th, 1914, the Chicago Tribune reported that with the death of Quillen, the former caretaker of the castle, the mysteries of Holmes' castle would remain unexplained. Quillen had committed suicide. His body was found in his bedroom with a note that read, "I couldn't sleep." Quillen's surviving relatives claim he had been haunted for several months and was suffering from hallucinations. The castle itself was mysteriously gutted by fire in August of 1895, according to a newspaper clipping from the New York Times. Two men were seen entering the back of the building between 8 and 9 p.m. About a half an hour later, they were seen exiting the building and rapidly running away. Following several explosions, the castle went up in flames. Afterwards, investigators found a half-empty gas can underneath the back steps of the building. The building survived the fire and remained in use until it was torn down in 1938. The site is occupied by the Englewood branch of the United States Postal Service. In 2017, amid allegations Holmes had in fact escaped execution, Holmes' body was exhumed for testing led by Janet Mong of the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. Due to his coffin being contained in cement, his body was found not to have decomposed normally. His clothes were almost perfectly preserved, and his mustache was found to be intact. The body was positively identified by his teeth as being that of Holmes. Holmes was then reburied. So it's amazing. Just a few years ago, he was up and his body was seeing the light of day, just to prove, in fact, that he was the man in the cement-covered casket. Quite an amazing story, and gruesome, obviously, as well.
Not a comforting death there. Seems like he struggled a bit before he died.
What a shame. You know, what a shame. It's like having pity on someone who is responsible for the deaths of thousands. You know, it's not that I'm making any sort of analogies, but it's just amazing what this guy got away with for so long, and then the horror that still follows his story. I mean, the caretaker of the home being haunted, you know, was he really haunted, or was it, you know, psychologically driven with all of the things that he knew about this horrible person that did these things in this building that you're taking care of? I'd be really interested to know what that postal office is like today in Chicago, if there's any activity in there in terms of paranormal activity.
Road trip.
That would be an interesting one. Just go knock on the door. Are you interested in buying a P.O. box? No, I'm actually interested to see how haunted as shit this building is, and get some stories out of that. I wonder if
I do find it interesting in many of these stories and finding more about these folks is the level of intelligence of this gentleman and his entrepreneurial spirit, his opportunity to maximize. He was in jail. He struck up a kinship with someone. It's interesting and terrifying that people who take one's life or multiple people's lives, their level of intelligence. This guy did not seem to be dumb.
No.
And was extremely, extremely dangerous. When you have a comfort level of being able to kill someone, let alone many people, and you combine that with intelligence, watch out.
If had it only been used in a positive way, he could have been extremely successful. He could have been anything. I mean, he could have been known that this entry wouldn't have been a dark side. It would have been, this is a man who did this or that or advanced medicine this way or that way. But no, he chose to go down this other dark, dark path. And I mean, it can go one way or the other. And the same is today. It can go one way or the other when you combine intelligence with, you know, sociopathic behavior. You can get some pretty amazing results that are disturbing as shit and destroy many, many, many lives.
Well, what's interesting is, I mean, we're talking about a story of people losing their lives, but it's just a reminder how much a simple choice can affect so much.
Yeah.
And we're obviously going through a time right now where some of us feel helpless, or even if we try very hard, can we really control? I mean, yeah, we really can. If you have the intelligence and the work ethic, you can help the greater good, or you can become a serial killer. It really is all about your life choices.
It is. And one simple, tiny choice can completely shape the rest of someone's life. And anyone who's lived, you know, a good portion of years and can look back on some decisions that were made this or there, or you introduced someone to somebody or this or that, and you see the path that things go down. It's really kind of crazy. Just how, you know, not like you raise your hand like I'm responsible for this, but in a way, you know, little decisions can have very big consequences that are, there's no way to predict them when they're made or even go down those paths. But had that choice not been made, this whole other path would never have opened. And I mean, that's life. It's always interesting to try and trace things back, you know, and you can only go so far in many cases, but it is amazing to see just where that can all lead to. That is going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia, the story of H.H. Holmes. If you like our show, press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. Leave us a review there on Apple Podcasts. We greatly appreciate it. Until next time, for Sean and all of us at Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.